one-man revolution, a guerrilla scholar warrior, a renaissance man for the new dark age. Welcome to Prof. CJ's Dangerous History Podcast.
Hey everybody, Prof. CJ here, and welcome to what'll become episode 40 of the Dangerous History Podcast. Had a little bit of kind of a leave of absence from the Dangerous History Podcast for about a week and a half. It's just been too crazy for me to get an episode out, and it's been kind of pissing me off that I've been so busy, because I really want to try to get at least one out per week, if not two, time permitting, but it's just been crazy. Won't bore you with the details, but suffice to say, a combination of things going on kind of at home and personal crap that I had to deal with, you know, even just stupid mundane shit like things breaking around the house that I've had to fix or at least get someone else to fix in some cases, combined with work being nuts, having, you know, lots of stuff going on at work, lots of things to grade, bullshit to deal with, and so on. And it's prevented me from having the time to work on the episodes that I've been trying to work on. You know, a lot of hours of research and preparation goes into each hour of actual podcasting. And that's not even talking about, you know, post-production and editing and all that sort of stuff. So anyway, my apologies. I really wanted to be with you more frequently over the past 10, 11 days, however long it's been. But now I can finally get back on it. Just a heads up of what to expect in the next week or so. I'm going to try and get out within the next 2 weeks, at least two episodes. One I'm working on is COINTELPRO, the FBI's counterintelligence program, which ran from the mid-50s into the early 70s and involved all sorts of illegal and unconstitutional spying on people, violating people's rights, harassing people, etc. And oftentimes just spying on them and harassing them simply from the basis of the ideological beliefs of particular groups and institutions, not because they had actually committed any crimes. Another thing that I'm working on and hope to have out in roughly the next week or two is a podcast about Colonel Edward Mandel House, who is one of these sort of guys behind the scenes who's actually more important than a lot of the people in the spotlight. Edward Mandel House is, to people who know him at all, they generally think of him as sort of Woodrow Wilson's right-hand man when Woodrow Wilson was president, and that's true, but there's more to House than just that. He's one of the most important, quote-unquote, men behind the curtain in 20th century American politics during a brief little era, but a crucial era in the early 20th century where the United States really started becoming the world's policeman. You know, first steps of that process I covered back with the Spanish and Filipino Wars, but it's World War I where Team America, as we know it, really gets rocking and rolling. So anyway, those are two episodes to look for in the next couple of weeks. Not sure which one will get done first. I'm still doing some of the research for those two. I think I'm a little further along with the COINTELPRO one, but we'll see. Anyway, today I'm going to talk about and also share with you excerpts from something totally unrelated in a direct way anyway to those two topics. I guess it is tangentially related. And that is some critiques of democracy and some concerns about potential dangers of democracy and some of an argument that democracy does not equate to freedom. That just because you have the ability to vote every now and then does not mean that you're free, which flies in the face of a lot of the official propaganda and narrative that the establishment gives you in the United States and in much of the Western world that, oh, you're free because you get to vote every now and then. That's what makes you free. And I don't believe that. I don't agree with that. And I'm going to be sharing with you some extensive excerpts from Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America, where he also criticizes this notion that democracy makes you free and that there's no danger of democracy becoming oppressive or what have you. So that's going to be the main topic for today, episode 40 of the Dangerous History Podcast. So let's get going. First, a little bit of background on who Alexis de Tocqueville was, in case you don't know, and the story behind what became a massive multi-volume work entitled Democracy in America. Alexis de Tocqueville was sort of a statesman, a philosopher, political scientist, though I don't think that term was in use in the early 19th century when he lived, but he really was, and even kind of a sociologist, though again, the word I don't think was around yet. He lived from 1805 to 1859, died relatively young, I believe of tuberculosis or something along those lines. He had an aristocratic background. He was born in northern France to an aristocratic Norman family, I think, that was actually related to William the Conqueror or one of the nobles who worked for William the Conqueror or something like that. Very educated guy, as typical of men of his class. And in most ways, you'd consider him a classical liberal, meaning sort of a proto-libertarian. Somebody who, when it came to politics, favored limited constitutional government, individual rights, also, you know, believe that civil society should handle most problems and that government only should have a few defined functions. He was a proponent of free trade and a proponent of the abolition of slavery, among other beliefs. So we might call him something like an early minarchist proto-libertarian, perhaps. And as such, his beliefs generally were in line with a lot of what America's founding fathers espoused as well. Now, in the early 1830s, when Old Hickory was still president, he traveled pretty extensively through the United States of the time. Originally, his mission was simply to study its prisons and then report back to people in France of the state of America's prison system and anything that France might learn from that. But as he traveled through the United States, he ended up studying much, much more and probably spent significantly more time studying other things about American society and institutions rather than prisons. He spent over a year in America, and when he left and went back to France, he did write up his report on prisons, but much more importantly, he wrote a far larger, what became multi-volume work entitled Democracy in America that becomes quite famous. It's still a classic and can be found in almost any decent-sized library or bookstore in America today, and I would assume in many other parts of the Western world as well, although I confess I haven't tried looking for it in libraries in Australia or Germany or whatever, so who knows, right? Overall, this is probably his most famous work. Towards the end of his life, he also wrote another influential work, probably his second most famous, entitled The Old Regime and the French Revolution. Or sometimes you see it as The Ancien Regime and the French Revolution, you know, depending on how much they want to translate the title from the French. An analysis of the French Revolution, and really what the revolution was about, what it accomplished, what it was and was not. And this, by the way, I also highly recommend, worth reading if you are interested not only in the French Revolution itself, but in questions of what are revolutions really about and are they really productive? In The Old Regime and the French Revolution, Tocqueville makes the argument, which I think actually stands even stronger today given subsequent scholarship and subsequent events. He makes the argument that the French revolutionaries and the revolution they ended up carrying out simply continued trends that the old regime had already begun under new, supposedly democratic republican auspices. So the trends in particular were the centralization of authority in France, which the kings of France had been carrying out for the previous couple of centuries prior to the revolution. Every generation, things were a little more centralized, a little bit less under local control and so on. And the net result was the French Revolution was simply just taking another giant step in that direction. And Tocqueville is largely a critic of how the French revolutionaries ran things. And I think part of his reasoning for that is because he thinks they were too inexperienced in real-world politics, the radicals who took over during the more radical phases of the revolution, and too attached to abstract Enlightenment ideas. And this caused them to not actually be able to run things very well. And in general, he was kind of a downer on the French Revolution and the French Republic that came out of it. And he seems to have thought, while he certainly acknowledged all sorts of flaws that the United States had, he seems to have thought that overall, Democratic-Republican institutions were functioning a lot better in the United States than they had in revolutionary France. And so one of the things he's sort of looking at in Democracy in America is, why is this? What's different about how representative republic institutions operated in the two countries? And one of the things he comes back to again and again throughout Democracy in America is the idea of decentralization, that the America of the Jacksonian era was highly decentralized. I mean, most important decisions were being made at like the town level, let alone the state level, and the federal government did very little of great importance to the average American at the time. So Tocqueville thinks that this was the main reason why representative republicanism was functioning relatively well in the America of the 1830s and had ended so disastrously during the French Revolution. Now, in Democracy in America, it's sort of like a combination of a travel book with political, philosophical, and sociological analysis, and even a little bit of crystal ball gazing towards the future. And Tocqueville is actually very, very perceptive. I think when an outsider travels through and really closely observes a society, they're going to notice a lot more than if somebody from that same society were to do the same thing. And the reason is because if you're traveling through and observing and writing down your observations of the society that you come from, there's a whole lot of things about that society that you're just going to take for granted, and so you're not going to notice, things which might be very unique or distinctive or quirky, idiosyncratic or any other synonym to your society, and you just won't even really hardly notice it. Whereas an outsider, an intelligent, perceptive outsider who's really paying attention and thinking about what he's seeing, is going to notice a hell of a lot more, and I think that describes Tocqueville. So Democracy in America, kind of like a combination of travel book with political, philosophical, sociological analysis, some prognostication for the future. Tocqueville has a lot of interesting things to say about a whole range of issues. I recommend reading Democracy in America if you haven't already. It's been some time since I sat down and read the whole thing. I did, though, a while back, I think when I was still an undergraduate. It's worth reading, even if you don't read the entire thing. There are parts of it that are kind of dry and boring, where he's just sort of describing stuff. But, man, there are some passages. I mean, he's a brilliant writer. He's a very intelligent and perceptive analyst. And there are some passages where he so eloquently nails things. He just really, crystallizes a lot of keen insights about America and just sort of about societies in general. So, I mean, just to give you one example of a prediction he made that ended up coming very true, all the way back in the 1830s, he basically predicted that in the 20th century, the two great world powers would be the United States and Russia. So, just one thing there. He has interesting observations on issues of race and slavery that are, in some cases, perhaps surprising. So, for example, there's a passage in Democracy in America where he compares free states to slave states and points out that not only does slavery harm the slave, that's obvious, and Tocqueville was an abolitionist, so, he's no fan of slavery. Blatantly obvious that slavery harms the slave, but Tocqueville argues it also hurts the master class, too, because it destroys their work ethic, it destroys their capacity for things like industry and self-improvement and so on, and makes them kind of lazy and decadent as a class. Interestingly, Tocqueville, at one point in Democracy in America, says that the states which in the 1830s used to have slavery and had given it up, which at that time meant basically the original Northeastern states, were actually more racist in terms of just sort of prejudice and attitudes and so on towards blacks than the Southern states, where they still own slaves. And furthermore, Tocqueville argued that the states, in his observation, where the people were the most racially prejudiced, were actually the states that had never had slavery at all. So states like Ohio and Indiana, right, that from the day they were created as states never had slavery in them. Anyway, these are just some of the things. I think it's worth reading if you've never read Tocqueville's Democracy in America. Good stuff. So anyway, the passage that I'm going to share with you today comes from chapter 6, and I'm going to combine and sort of tack back and forth between Tocqueville's words and my own thoughts, either sort of translating in some cases his 180 years ago language to modern terminology, or giving my take or my insights. So, you know, Tocqueville's long dead. I can't interview him, unfortunately. So this is kind of the next best thing. So, excerpt from Tocqueville's Democracy in America, Chapter 6. Chapter title is, What Sort of Despotism Democratic Nations Have to Fear? I had remarked during my stay in the United States that a democratic state of society, similar to that of the Americans, might offer singular facilities for the establishment of despotism. So, we're going to look at Tocqueville's thoughts on how despotism might come about in a democratic society, and perhaps the characteristics of such a regime. So, this is the words of Tocqueville now, quote, It would seem that if despotism were to be established among the democratic nations of our days, it might assume a different character, by which he means a different character than sort of ancient despotisms, good old-fashioned, you know, tyrannies. Continuing Tocqueville's words, it would be more extensive and more mild. It would degrade men without tormenting them, end quote. So, more extensive and more mild. That a democracy that becomes despotic, that becomes oppressive, it would be more extensive in that it would actually seek to control more of your life, more aspects, more facets of your life than a good old-fashioned, you know, just tyrannical king would. But more mild, meaning it's not going to be as brutally, blatantly obvious, the pressure taking place, the oppression taking place. So, I think what he means here is that in the old days of just a good old-fashioned tyrannical monarch, the kings actually didn't have as many rules as modern democracies tend to. The king, you know, had a relatively small amount of rules. Like, you know, might be don't criticize him, don't, you know, badmouth him or the monarchy as an institution. Pay your taxes. You know, don't ever plot to undermine the king and kind of just obey sort of basic laws. And other than that, I mean, kings often left their subjects alone as long as they're just sort of paying their taxes, not complaining, not resisting, and so on. You can look back to perhaps ancient Persia as an example of this, where there was a high degree of civil liberties in a lot of ways. You know, outside the areas of there wasn't, you know, pure free speech or whatever. But, you know, for the most part, if you paid your taxes to the Persian empire of old and, you know, didn't badmouth the emperor too much, didn't plot to overthrow him, you could mostly just go about your business and, you know, not have your life micromanaged the way modern democracies sometimes are wont to do. But a modern democracy's oppression will be more mild. In other words, you know, a king of old, if you violated his rules, the punishments could be blatant, draconian, brutal, public, you know, being torn to pieces in the public square and so on. Whereas a democracy, usually the punishments are not that brutally violent and gory in most cases. It's the punishments are more subtle, or at least the iron fist is a little more concealed. Tocqueville continues, I think, then, that the species of oppression by which democratic nations are menaced is unlike anything that ever before existed in the world. Our contemporaries will find no prototype of it in their memories. I seek in vain for an expression that will accurately convey the whole of the idea I have formed of it. The old words, despotism and tyranny, are inappropriate. The thing itself is new, and since I cannot name, I must attempt to define it. End quote. So yeah, Tocqueville's saying, this type of despotism, which, by the way, was only a twinkle in the 1830s, was only a tiny seed in the 1830s, was nothing like the oppressive amounts of regulations and laws and controls and tax codes that we suffer under today. I mean, if you compare today's federal government with that of the 1830s, I mean, the federal government of the 1830s almost didn't exist. You know, there's no income tax. The average American could live their entire life in most parts of the country without ever having any firsthand contact with the federal government in any way other than using the postal service. Right? And yet Tocqueville already is seeing some of the potential seeds for democratic republics to become oppressive, and he's saying this is a different kind of oppression than we've seen historically. It's a new thing. We don't just have an easy handle to label it, so I'm going to have to lay out what it is. So Tocqueville continues, "I seek to trace the novel features under which despotism may appear in the world. The first thing that strikes the observation is an innumerable multitude of men, all equal and alike, incessantly endeavoring to procure the petty and paltry pleasures with which they glut their lives. Each of them, living apart, is as a stranger to the fate of all the rest. His children and his private friends constitute to him the whole of mankind. As for the rest of his fellow citizens, he is close to them, but he does not see them. He touches them, but he does not feel them. He exists only in himself and for himself alone. And if his kindred still remain to him, he may be said, at any rate, to have lost his country." So you have, this is you know, my words again, right? End quote for Tocqueville. You have a whole bunch of just masses of men who are roughly equal and similar, but they're atomized. They're not really connected to each other in any meaningful ways. They're just sort of concerned with kind of their day-to-day, you know, pleasures and stuff. Gee, does that sound like anyone we might know? Now, having described these atomized people who are just sort of lost in their own little world, Tocqueville then continues describing what's over them. Quote, "Above this race of men stands an immense and tutelary power," by which he means the government, "which takes upon itself alone to secure their gratifications and to watch over their fate. That power is absolute, minute, regular, provident, and mild. It would be like the authority of a parent if, like that authority, its object was to prepare men for manhood. But it seeks, on the contrary, to keep them in perpetual childhood. It is well content that the people should rejoice, provided they think of nothing but rejoicing. For their happiness, such a government willingly labors, but it chooses to be the sole agent and the only arbiter of that happiness. It provides for their security, foresees and supplies their necessities, facilitates their pleasures, manages their principal concerns, directs their industry, regulates the descent of property, and subdivides their inheritances. What remains but to spare them all the care of thinking and all the trouble of living? Thus, it every day renders the exercise of the free agency of man less useful and less frequent. It circumscribes the will within a narrower range and gradually robs a man of all the uses of himself." End quote. So you've got this power above you that rules you, but it generally rules you in a way that at least appears to be benevolent or at least benign. But in the process of so doing, it claims that it's taking care of you. It claims it's only concerned with looking out for what's best for you. Whether it actually means that or not, whether it actually is doing that or not, the point is it takes away your ability to make your own decisions with important parts of your life. And I think, and I think Tocqueville would agree with me on this, that you're, based on things he says later in the passage that we'll get to, that human beings making decisions for their lives, what to do with their lives, what to do with their resources, and so on, that is a practice that's sort of like a muscle. And if you're out of the habit of making your own decisions and running your own life. It's like a muscle that atrophies severely. You get to the point where you don't even want to make decisions for your own life. You would have trouble doing it, and you actually are relieved that there are people in authority who will take care of decision-making for you. It calls to mind, at least to me anyway, the way he describes it as the government's looking out for you, but and it does want to make you happy, but it wants to be the only thing that makes you happy at the end of the day, and it's doing so in kind of a weird way. It makes me think of, you know, a smiling, good-looking bureaucrat or agent saying, I'm just here to help, right? This is for your own good, sort of smiley face fascism, right? Hidden in a velvet glove, but it is ultimately controlling you. Tocqueville continues. After having thus successively taken each member of the community in its powerful grasp and fashioned him at will, the supreme power then extends its arm over the whole community. It covers the surface of society with a network of small, complicated rules, minute and uniform, through which the most original minds and the most energetic characters cannot penetrate to rise above the crowd. The will of man is not shattered, but softened, bent, and guided. Men are seldom forced by it to act, but they are constantly restrained from acting. Such a power does not destroy, but it prevents existence. It does not tyrannize, but it compresses, enervates, extinguishes, and stupefies a people till each nation is reduced to nothing better than a flock of timid and industrious animals, of which the government is the shepherd. End quote. Now, there's a lot of interesting stuff in that paragraph right there. That, to me, is one of the most eloquent paragraphs in all of Tocqueville's work, and he's a very eloquent writer all the time. So, I mean, I only wish I could write that way, right? Covering society with a network of small, complicated rules through which, you know, it's difficult for people to rise above the crowd, that calls to mind, you know, extensive regulations, right? You think about, like, the tens of thousands of regulations on things like economic life that exist. And if you've ever started a business or known somebody who started a business, you understand how much red tape and hurdles and so on you have to deal with. It really is sometimes almost seems like they don't want you starting your own business. They want you to just go to work for somebody else in a big business that already exists, doesn't it? It's almost like they don't want you to be an independent economic actor. And at the end of that paragraph where Tocqueville talks about it's turning you into livestock animals, basically, and the government's your shepherd, that's, you know, I think very true. And it's funny when people, whether in a religious context or in a secular context, when they refer to a shepherd, a good shepherd, as the standard of leadership, it is kind of darkly hilarious when you really think about that, because of course, why does the shepherd, assuming he is a decent shepherd, a competent shepherd, why does the shepherd take good care of his flock of whatever animal? Because he wants to exploit them in the future. Because he wants them to be more healthy and productive so that he can exploit more from them, right? Whether it's wool or milk or meat or whatever it is he's harvesting from his livestock, the shepherd doesn't take good care and watch out for his animals, his flock, because he's just a nice guy and an animal lover and he just wants them to be happy for their own sake. He only wants them to be happy in so much as that happiness will make them more productive. It's very important. Sorry if I just ruined that metaphor for you. Next time somebody who's trying to either claim some sort of authority over you or legitimize some sort of authority that already is over you and uses the shepherd metaphor, maybe you'll remember that this is not as benign of a metaphor as people often think. The shepherd only takes care of his livestock so that he can get more out of them. Continuing in the words of Tocqueville, I have always thought that servitude of the regular, quiet, and gentle kind, which I have just described, might be combined more easily than is commonly believed with some of the outward forms of freedom, and that it might even establish itself under the wing of the sovereignty of the people. Our contemporaries are constantly excited by two conflicting passions. They want to be led, and they wish to remain free. As they cannot destroy either the one or the other of these contrary propensities, they strive to satisfy them both at once. They devise a sole, tutelary, and all-powerful form of government, but elected by the people. They combine the principle of centralization and that of popular sovereignty. This gives them a respite. They console themselves for being in tutelage by the reflection that they have chosen their own guardians. Every man allows himself to be put in leading strings because he sees that it is not a person or a class of persons, but the people at large who hold the end of the chain. End quote. So we have these conflicting desires. On the one hand, to be led. On the other hand, to remain free. These are contradictory. They're, at least, you know, in their conclusion, they're mutually exclusive. So how do people, in a ridiculous way, try to satisfy both of these contradictory things at once? By having a super all-powerful government that fixes your desire to be led, but by having it be elected. This gives you at least the belief that you're free, even though you have this powerful government apparatus controlling your life. The fact that you get to vote on who are the people at the top every now and then is supposed to mean that it's all not a violation of your freedom. Tocqueville continues, "By this system, the people shake off their state of dependence just long enough to select their master, and then relapse into it again. A great many persons at the present day are quite contented with this sort of compromise between administrative despotism and the sovereignty of the people. And they think they have done enough for the protection of individual freedom when they have surrendered it to the power of the nation at large. This does not satisfy me. The nature of him I am to obey signifies less to me than the fact of extorted obedience," end quote. And I would agree with Tocqueville's sentiments. The fact that somebody is giving me orders is much more important than how the guy got into that position. In other words, just because a guy got to be in charge through an election doesn't mean that when he's giving you orders, he's being any less oppressive to you, if he's giving you orders contrary to what you would prefer to do. Tocqueville continues, "I admit that, by this means, room is left for the intervention of individuals in the more important affairs, but it is not the less suppressed in the smaller and more private ones. It must not be forgotten that it is especially dangerous to enslave men in the minor details of life. For my own part, I should be inclined to think freedom less necessary in great things than in little ones, if it were possible to be secure of the one without possessing the other. Subjection in minor affairs breaks out every day and is felt by the whole community indiscriminately. It does not drive men to resistance, but it crosses them at every turn till they are led to surrender the exercise of their own free will. Thus their spirit is gradually broken and their character enervated. Whereas that obedience which is exacted on a few important but rare occasions only exhibits servitude at certain intervals and throws the burden of it upon a small number of men. It is vain to summon a people who have been rendered so dependent on the central power to choose from time to time the representatives of that power. This rare and brief exercise of their free choice, however important it may be, will not prevent them from gradually losing the faculties of thinking, feeling, and acting for themselves, and thus gradually falling below the level of humanity. I admit that they will soon become incapable of exercising the great and only privilege which remains to them. The democratic nations that have introduced freedom into their political constitution, at the very time when they were augmenting the despotism of their administrative constitution, have been led into strange paradoxes. To manage those minor affairs in which good sense is all that is wanted, the people are held to be unequal to the task. But when the government of the country is at stake, the people are invested with immense powers. They are alternately made the playthings of their ruler and his masters, more than kings and less than men. It is indeed difficult to conceive how men who have entirely given up the habit of self-government should succeed in making a proper choice of those by whom they are to be governed. End quote. So, people's lives, the small decisions of your lives, what to do with your time, with your money, your resources, what to do with your own body in some cases, all of these things are taken out of your hands, or at least your decisions within those realms are severely limited by rules and regulations and laws. The either unspoken or spoken premise behind a lot of these rules, these little tiny laws and regulations, is that people are incompetent to run their own lives. They're incompetent to decide what to do with their own money in a lot of cases. They're incompetent to decide what to do with their own body and so on. So you have to have rules because the people are incompetent of making little decisions. But then at the same time, you're saying they ought to have the ability to make the decision of the people in charge of the state. Well, how can people be simultaneously totally incapable of making little decisions about how to run their lives and business, but at the same time are totally competent to make a decision on who's in charge, right? That's the contradiction that Tocqueville's getting at here, I think. So in one of the previous passages that I just read a minute ago, Tocqueville was talking about this weird contradiction in democracies where simultaneously they appear to be enlarging rights and freedoms and that sort of thing. And at the same time, they're creating this administrative apparatus, what, you know, largely we think of this as bureaucracy, right? That is not at all democratic and in fact is increasingly authoritarian and is largely shielded from electoral influence. So the last paragraph of this excerpt I want to read to you gets into a little bit more of that. Tocqueville writes, "A constitution, republican in its head, and ultra-monarchical in all its other parts, has always appeared to me to be a short-lived monster. The vices of rulers and the ineptitude of the people would speedily bring about its ruin, and the nation, weary of its representatives and of itself, would create freer institutions, or soon return to stretch itself at the feet of a single master," end quote. So you have this self-contradictory thing. It's almost like a freakish creature out of Greek mythology, right? A constitution that is on the one hand republican in its head, meaning the people who are at the top are elected, but ultra-monarchical in all its other parts, meaning the real apparatus of government, the bureaucrats, the administrators, the enforcers, these people are not elected. These people are, you know, insulated from popular sovereignty to the degree that popular sovereignty even exists, which is, you know, it's a whole nother problem altogether that I won't get into here because of time. But I mean, the way I think about this sort of a government where it's on the one hand, there's this democratic part, and on the other hand, there's this very authoritarian, undemocratic part. It's like a hybrid animal that's a shitty one of either. Here's what I mean by that. I know that doesn't sound particularly sensical, but imagine an animal whose front half was a fish and whose lower half was a mammal. That animal would be a really shitty fish and a really shitty mammal, right? It wouldn't be particularly good at anything. And in fact, it would probably die real fast because the front half of it would need to breathe water through gills, and the rear half would be, wanting to breathe air through lungs. So such a hybrid monster, some sort of Frankenstein creation, would not live very long, and its life would be mostly pretty pitiful. Well, that I think is how Tocqueville's trying to portray this contradictory sort of government he saw already beginning to emerge in representative democratic republic institutions, where aspects of it are democratic, aspects of it are authoritarian, and these contradictions cannot hold indefinitely. And so he says, it's going to collapse either back towards more freedom, real freedom, or it's going to fall in another direction towards people just at the end of the day saying, screw it, this isn't working, we'd rather just have a genuine authoritarian institution, a genuine tyranny. So, what do you think? Do you think that what we have now in the United States, and really in a lot of ways in most of the rest of the world, is a system that is Republican in its head, but ultra-monarchical in all its other parts? Do you think that's actually an apt description of what we have today? Do you agree with Tocqueville that it's a short-lived monster? And if so, which way do you think it will collapse? Either towards more freedom or towards more tyranny? It's a chilling thing to think about. And to me, I think one of the broader points that this excerpt brings up is the whole notion of whether or not democracy actually equates to freedom, something you're often encouraged to think, either explicitly or implicitly. But democracy is just the method of choosing the people in charge, if we mean, you know, typical modern representative democracy, right? It's just the method of picking who's going to be in charge of the apparatus of the state is voting rather than inheritance, flipping a coin, or, you know, paper, rock, scissors, lizard, Spock. And the methodology by which the people at the head of the state are chosen doesn't really have anything to do with the question of whether or not you're free one way or the other. Because whether or not you're free revolves around the degree to which you are or are not controlled in what you do with your life and your liberty and your property and the time on this earth. I would argue, for example, that we're not particularly free in the United States today for a variety of reasons, and just one example I would take is the war on drugs. The war on drugs is, like alcohol prohibition before it, based on the premise that individuals are not allowed to be the final authority, the final arbiter on what they put or do not put into their own body. Saying, no, you don't have the final say on what you choose to put into your body or not put into your body by drinking, smoking, snorting, whatever, right? That the state has the last say on those questions. Now, is there any more intimate question than what you do or do not put into your own body? Is there anything more intimate than that that you can think of? And you're told, no, you don't have the final say on this. We'll override you by force if necessary. Now, I would argue that one of the principles of ownership of something is that you have the right to decide what to do or not do with it. You know, limitations on using it to harm others, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, of course. But, you know, if you owned a car, right? If you owned a car, it's yours, it's paid for, it's, you know, you don't owe anybody money on it, whatever, it's bought and paid for, it is yours, you have the title to it. Don't you have the right to do whatever you want with that car as long as you're not harming anyone else or their property? Including, by the way, things that are stupid or destructive, right? If you own a car, do you have the right to dump sand in its gas tank and mess it up? You absolutely do. Now, it might be stupid. We might all want to persuade you not to do that. But there's no basis for the SWAT team coming and dragging you off to prison for damaging your own car. We would all look at it and say, that's stupid, that's wasteful, that makes no sense. But at the same time, it's your car, so if you want to destroy it, we think it's dumb, but that's your business. Same thing, if you had a beautiful car that you own, was totally paid off, and one day you just decided, for whatever reason, you were going to smack it with a sledgehammer and mess it up. Again, we might all look at you like you're crazy. We might all criticize you and try to persuade you not to do that, but we wouldn't send in a SWAT team to drag you off to prison. Why? Because that's your car. You own it, so you can decide even to do stupid things to it, as long as you're not hurting anybody else or their stuff. Well, do you own your own body? I would argue that at least you know, as the system currently is, you do not, because you don't get to have the last say on whether or not, you know, what substances go into your body. So you cannot be the owner of your body in the current system, because you don't have the final say on what to do with it. Including, by the way, doing, and I'm not saying that there aren't bad effects that come from drugs and there aren't, you know, dangerous drugs and blah, blah, blah. The point is, who gets to make the last decision on the question, right? Just like, you know, do you have the right to deface your own car if it's, you know, yours? So you don't, in the current system, own your own body, your own self. You don't, because you don't have the last say of what to do with it. Even self-destructive things. Now, there is a word for a person who does not own his own body, his own self. There is a word. It's an old word. It's kind of a disheartening word. And of course, the word is slave. So the fact that periodically you get to cast a ballot for a couple of pre-approved alternatives that you didn't even have a hand in selecting in the first place does not change the fact that you do not own yourself. I'll just use one last analogy here to try and illustrate the point further, and I'm hope that I'm just provoking you to think a bit more and to question things if you never have questioned the civic religion of the magic of democracy before. Suppose you and I and a bunch of other people, we all lived on a small island that was a private plantation owned by a master, right, who owned the island and owned all the equipment and facilities on the island. And we're all slaves. We all work and grow his crops and so on. And they provide us with basic housing and food and whatever, but we have to do what they say. Now, let's say that it's quite an enlightened, progressive slave master, and he's nice enough that every 4 years he decides to let us vote. In free and fair and non-rigged elections, he presents us with two possible overseers. And we get to decide which overseer gets to be our, you know, the guy running us, the guy telling us what to do and punishing us if we don't do what he says and so on for the next 4 years. And we get into passionate arguments leading up to these elections. We're practically going to fists against each other, going to blows against each other over which overseer is preferable, right? And so, you know, who are we going to pick? Overseer Bob or Overseer Jim? And you very passionately say, well, Overseer Bob wants to reduce the number of lashes that you get for disobedience, so I want to vote for Overseer Bob. And I say, yeah, but Overseer Jim is promising that we'll get slightly better food if he's our overseer, so you should vote for Jim, and if you don't, you're an evil asshole, right? And of course, we only have the ability to choose between the alternatives presented to us by the people really in charge, on whom we never actually have the ability to vote. Furthermore, we have no ability to cast a ballot that says, I just would like to own myself, thanks, and I don't really want an overseer at all. Well, question, under those circumstances in that hypothetical island plantation, where we get to vote for our own overseers every few years, does anybody think that our condition there should be called one of freedom? And I know you're wondering, what does this crazy hypothetical island plantation have to do with how we live now? And, well, to ask that question is to answer it. So I hope I've given you some stuff to think about, some of the flaws in the logic of democracy and some of the potential dangers in it, and the fact that there's different types of oppression. Some of it's more obvious and blatant than others, and some of it's more subtle, but it's no less oppression because of that. And I hope that some of Tocqueville's words, which are far more eloquent than mine, have given you some food for thought as well. Because I think Tocqueville, even when I don't agree with 100% of everything Tocqueville says, but he's one of those guys that I think is always worth reading and thinking about. He's always very, very penetrating thinker and, you know, provokes more thoughts in you as you read him and think about him. So as always, I appreciate your time. Thank you for listening. I hope I've given you some stuff to think about. And again, like I always say, if you have any comments about this particular episode, please feel free to leave them in the comment section for the episode. on the website, profcj.org. Also, you can email me at the email address, profcj@profcj.org. Any type of comments, feedback, suggestions, so on. You can also connect with the show on Facebook and on Twitter. You know, like the show on Facebook if you're on Facebook. I have a Facebook page for the show. I haven't done a whole lot with it. I've mostly just sort of posted, you know, episode updates and whatever. I'm going to try, you know, to get a little bit more involved with that. I've been a little bit more active on Twitter, so you can also follow the show on Twitter. Looking ahead, I already mentioned a couple of the episodes I'm working on for the near future. I'm also looking to, hopefully in the near future, start doing the occasional interview show where I talk to historical experts on topics that are related to the themes of this podcast. Remember, there are several ways you can support this show. One, of course, is just simply to spread the word about it any way you can to people you think might appreciate it. You know, whatever you have in terms of media outlets, everything from blogs to websites, Facebook, Twitter, social media, etc. If you enjoy this show, please help it get a wider audience. That'd be great. You can also help the show out by leaving a review or a rating in iTunes so that other people might want to give the show a shot. And you can also help the show financially. I try to get by with as little of cost as I can. This is guerrilla intellectual warfare here, but of course, it's still not free. And you can help the show financially by donating directly. It's profcj.org/donate on the website. And for those of you who have donated already, thank you very much. 1,000 thank yous. Every little bit helps absolutely. And I hope others of you will consider donating as well. And you can also, without actually donating, you can help the podcast financially by purchasing Amazon items by going through the Amazon affiliate links on my website, profcj.org.
Thanks for listening to the Dangerous History Podcast. Check us out at profcj.org. That's profcj.org.